We finished up our series on the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew, and I haven't totally committed to where we're going next, but this week we're going to go into the Gospel of John. Our sister church over in New York is doing a series right now where we're encouraging all the membership to grab folks and study the Gospel of John together. So we've got handouts and guides, and they're weekly going through it. So for the next 21 weeks, or I guess they're about a week in now, so the next 20 weeks, they'll be working through the Gospel of John. And so I thought it would be kind of fitting, since they're now out past chapter 1, to jump in on chapter 1 and talk about it on Sunday. But also it fits with some things going on in their church. We had the Gideons in this week, and also with us as we talk about how to engage our community. John chapter 1 talks about how Jesus reaches us. And so we get Jesus' model for engaging the lost. And it's more than chapter 1. You could argue the Gospel of John as a whole watches Jesus do that. John has a very different agenda from, say, Matthew, where we were reading last, whereas Matthew was written with very much a focus on the kingdom and how the kingdom is established and the fact that Jesus makes disciples and what these people who follow Jesus are like. John has a different driving focus when it comes to sharing his experience with Jesus. And at the core of it is he just wants us to get to know Jesus himself. For John, the question is, who is Jesus? And what do you need to know about him? And that agenda drives John in such a way that his gospel is unique among our four gospels. Matthew, Mark, and Luke, they track pretty well together. A lot of times they'll even tell the same story with the same words. We even go into the Greek and it's word for word identical in different spots. Most things are generally in similar order. And then John shows up. And John does his own thing. John puts them in different orders. John tells us stories that the other Gospels didn't hit on at all. And John will take, more than any of the other ones, will take time to step aside and dive into the theology that's being revealed in what just happened. And so he'll see something and then he'll launch into, you know, and this is what we know. And you hear that right at the start of John, because he starts his gospel very different than the others. In Matthew, Mark, and Luke, you know, we get things like genealogies and birth stories, how Jesus come onto the scene. And that's not good enough for John. We can't just start for when Jesus was born or do like Matthew and trace his genealogy back to Abraham. No, for John, he wants to start at the beginning of all time. In the beginning was the Word. He jumps all the way back, and he gives us this big view of who is Jesus in the big picture, and then grounds it in the significance of the Incarnation. Because John wants you to catch the theology, in the section we're going to look at today, which is verses 1 through 18, he's going to tell essentially the same story three times from different angles. In all likelihood, John is not concerned with following a chronological order. In fact, as authors have tried to sort out, even just looking at the geographical markers in John, it's a mess if you try and make it in order. For us, I think we struggle with that because our culture is obsessed with time, and so everything has to be a reporter's account done in order. That wasn't weird in their day, and so John's not out of place. And there's really no reason to think John was going to do that just from the way he opens when he starts with this big picture and then loops through it three times. You already see that for him, the order is not important. You need to know the point. You need to know who is Jesus. And so John's going to roll that way. And the core of what we're going to take today is his three loops. He's going to run through the Incarnation, how Jesus took on flesh and came to be with us. And so if I was going to summarize our point today, is incarnational ministry is unveiling the glory of God in dark places. That's going to be our challenge as we look at Jesus' example, to follow Jesus in that model of having an incarnational ministry that unveils the glory of God in dark places. So follow with me. I'm going to be reading from the ESV, verses 1 down through 18. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things were made through him, and without him was not anything made that was made. In him was life, and the life was the light of men. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. There was a man sent from God whose name was John. He came as a witness to bear witness about the light, that all might believe through him. He was not the light, but came to bear witness about the light. The true light, which gives light to everyone, was coming into the world. He was in the world, and the world was made through him, yet the world did not know him. He came to his own, and his own people did not receive him. But to all who did receive him, who believed in his name, he gave the right to become the children of God, who were born not of blood, nor of the will of the flesh, nor of the will of man, but of God. And the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we have seen his glory, glory as of the only Son from the Father, full of grace and truth. John bore witness about him and cried out, "This was he of whom I said, 'He who comes after me ranks before me, because he was before me.' For from his fullness we have received grace upon grace. For the law was given through Moses, grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. No one has ever seen God. The only God who is at the Father's side, he has made him known." That's John's intro. As you hear, he keeps jumping back to who Jesus is, walking through Jesus' entrance into the world, and sort of giving summary statements of his ministry, and then doing it again, and fleshing out and defining what he's talking about. The other interesting thing I meant to mention about John is, on the one hand, John is the easiest Greek to translate in the New Testament. His vocabulary is simple. His grammar doesn't mess with you. Paul uses big words. Some of them we think he might have made up on the fly. He takes two words and just combines them. We don't have record in any other Greek writing of that word, but we know what it means. We can see what he's doing. He reminds us a lot of Bible college professors who do exactly that. The joke when I was in college is, when you get your doctorate, you're allowed to make up words. And that's kind of Paul. And his sentences will flow for paragraphs. And so when you're trying to diagram them and translate them to English, which isn't allowed to do that, Paul's hard, not John. Every first semester Greek student gets to translate John. We start in John 1 because it's accessible. What I love in that is, I say that and you go, really? Because when I read John, he's deep. And he is. He doesn't have the polish of the language. He doesn't have the lengthy sentences. But that doesn't mean that John is dumb. In fact, what you see in John is a picture of what God does. He grabs simple, everyday people and uses them profoundly. And that's John. He outlives the other apostles and writes a gospel that has a depth that you can just chew on. And that's what God does, is he takes us as we are, he fills us with his Spirit, and the gospel message is powerful. And so as we walk with John through this passage, one of the reminders is, this light coming into darkness, this life coming to the dead, caught John. And John just wants us to meet this Jesus who changed him. In John's gospel, he doesn't refer to himself as John. He always refers to himself as the disciple who Jesus loved. I think you catch his heart here. The reason John wants to loop through this and make sure we don't miss anything about Jesus is because John met Jesus, and John was profoundly changed by Jesus. And so as he jumps in, he's just dying to help make sure we don't blow past and just catch some random details. Oh, there was a guy, he was born, he did some stuff. He says, no, you don't understand. This was the Word, the eternal Word that was in the beginning with the Father. One of the first things that John hits on is that Jesus is God. John, unlike any of the other Gospels, is extremely explicit. I'm not saying Matthew, Mark, and Luke don't affirm that Jesus is God. They do. But sometimes they do it in fancy, creative ways where people try and argue that maybe Scripture didn't say that. John just doesn't give us that kind of room. And we've talked about ways to see what an author's point is in a passage. We've said, well, if they repeat an idea, that's definitely a big idea for them. One of the other things, and you do this in your own conversation, is when you start and end with the same concept. We call it bracketing when you're doing your studies. But anytime you're making a point, you introduce it, you talk for a while, and then you should come back and conclude that. And so if there's a point at the beginning and end of a discourse, it's one of the main points. And for John, in this chunk, that's that Jesus is God. He opens with, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And then he ends with this mission that, you know, no one has seen God the Father. In mind here, we have like Moses. He says, Lord, let me see you. And he says, if I show you my glory, you'll die. He says, no one's seen him but the only God. Some of your translations say the only Son. The word's not in there, but it's who we're talking about. Who is at the Father's side. This is referring back to the beginning, the one who's with him and calling him God, has made him known. That in Jesus, who is God, we get a revelation of God. And that's what John wants us to catch. That when you meet Jesus, you meet God. And as you get to know Jesus, he reveals to you the God that's, in a sense, unknowable. That the God who was far away and seemed incomprehensible becomes comprehensible in Jesus. That one of Jesus' primary roles is as God to reveal God. It's why we would say that Jesus is the fullest revelation of God. Yes, this pushes us into those difficult doctrines of the Trinity. I was reading this week, the one guy said, all analogies of the Trinity are inaccurate, and that's true. There's nothing like the Trinity. And so anytime we make an analogy, it's usually closer to a heresy in its description than it is to an actual. Because what we have to say here is exactly what John does in verse 1, which is that Jesus was both with God, too, distinct, and they have different roles. He's the one that creates, and yet he is God, one. And the church has struggled with good ways to say that, because I don't exist as a plurality in a singleness. You know, we're all located as one person. And yet we have to affirm that God is three persons and one being, one in essence. That's one God, eternally existent in three persons, God the Father, God the Son, God the Holy Spirit. And John 1 is one of the many passages that push us to say that. And what I want to encourage you is the very fact that the Trinity doesn't fit in our brains very well proves John's point. That the God that is outside of our understanding, that we can't see or grasp, is at least drawing near enough that we can grasp at him in Jesus. That Jesus makes the God who is beyond us near us. And so Jesus is God, and we have to affirm that. If you've ever gotten to have a nice chat with a Jehovah's Witness, you'll know their version of the Bible reworks verse 1 and says, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was a God. That way they can get away from a Trinitarian statement. Without getting into lots of tedious details, that just doesn't work in the Greek. In fact, some guys have suggested a better way to translate this would be to say, and what God was, the Word was also. Because the grammar actually pushes these two into an equation sort of statement, where the one is like the other. And there's different Greek words if we wanted to say that the Word had attributes of divinity. That's a different word, and would have been spelled different in the Greek. I mean, straight down to how we spell it, pushes a different way and says, no, God and the Word, same deal. And so this is how John opens. He says, Jesus is not created. He is eternal. He was with God in the very beginning, before anything was made. And that everything that was made with him. And so he's looking back at Genesis and saying, when you see in Genesis it says, and God spoke and this stuff happened, Jesus is in the midst of that. In fact, Jesus exists as the Word spoken, which shows you that Jesus' role has always been revelatory. That what Jesus does in the Godhead is he reveals, he communicates, and he speaks. They're not stagnant or stationary, but that God has been active, and this has been Jesus' role from all time. And in fact, the word was with God. The word for with there is pros in the Greek, which carries an idea of toward. It's this idea that they've been actively interacting from all time, and then in creation, that interaction flows out to us. That's our God. And if that pushes your brain just a little bit, good. I think that's what John's after. So as we dive into that, so then what happens when God reveals himself? When God the Son shows up to reveal to us God? There's a couple things John highlights, and he hits these in each of his loops. The way I would look at the loops are 1 through 5 is his first intro of the Word from before all time. And then in verse 5, the light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. We see the Word, Jesus' ministry in our midst as a light in darkness. He backs up in 6 through 13 and does it again. Starts with John the Baptist now bearing witness and a light coming into the world. Again, these are both Jesus' entrance, Jesus' birth and incarnation. And then he talks about that the world didn't actually recognize him. And so he's talking about Jesus' ministry again. That even though he came into the world that he made, they don't get it. And then verses 14 down through 18, he does it again. The Word became flesh. He backs up to the incarnation. And then he talks about his ministry, and we have seen his glory, and talks about it again. So that's sort of our three loops. And in them, there's a couple things he uses to talk about. As Jesus reveals, what does he do? He brings life. And when God is revealed, that revelation brings life. In him was life, and the life was the light of men. That life is in Jesus. What he's getting at is the state of our world without Jesus is dead. And we need life to come. And if we're going to find life, we find it in Jesus. And then he even pushes it harder that this life-giving act of God is a miraculous work of God. He says that this life-giving, he describes as becoming children of God. We get adopted into God's family. And we are born not of blood, not of the will of the flesh, nor of the will of man, but of God. What he's stressing there is that salvation is a miracle. And the idea is it's dead people coming back to life and getting adopted into a family. A lot of times we talk about miracles, and I believe God can do anything he wants. So don't hear me saying that God doesn't do miraculous works. But a lot of times we make it sound like God's not doing tons of miracles unless, like, the dead are being raised physically or lame people are jumping up. What we need to understand is this is a bigger miracle. Because if you raise somebody from the dead, they will die again. And even if you could keep doing it, they will keep dying. But when God reaches down into a person who is spiritually dead and revives them, they step into eternity. And he's pointing out that if the situation is that we need life and we're dead, then it's going to take a work of God for that to happen. Because even if I could come up with a to-do list on how to come back from the dead, if I hand it to a corpse, even if my to-do list is accurate, all it will do is lay on top of the dead body. He's not going to go, oh, step one, let me knock that out. And in John's view, this is the world that God looked down into and in love engages, is we are a dead world and in Jesus' life. And that life comes to us. And it comes by us becoming God's children. In him was life, we become children of God. And he gives a contrast between in Moses, we had the law, but in Jesus, we have grace and truth. That in Jesus' life-giving work, he brings it through grace and truth. The law had a way of bringing truth, not so much on grace. It could show what was wrong. The Romans would say the law reveals our wickedness, but the law couldn't save. In Jesus, we get grace and truth, which ultimately adds up to grace upon grace. And we've hit this before, but I'll always come back to this. When we talk about Jesus being about grace, we're acknowledging that he does not overlook or deny or sweep under the rug sin. It's true and accurate. It says, yeah, you are dead, and it's your own fault. But it will make a way that we can deal with it to redeem you. And so this life he gives doesn't deny what the world is. He sees us as we are, and even we will say reveals us as we are. But his angle here is not simply to condemn, but to revive. That Jesus steps into a dead world, and rather than just diagnose them, yep, that one's dead, he comes to bring them life. And we see something about the heart and nature of God in that revelation. This is John's summary. The big points of how does Jesus reveal God is God is a life-giving God who brings life to the dead. And that might seem impossible, and it is. But it's a miraculous work of God. So when he refers to works of the flesh and works of the will of man, most likely he's referring to what he comes back to, the law versus grace. That is not that we get salvation by following the rules, the law, my own flesh, my own ability, or by somebody else doing it, but it's a work of God. So I can't will you into salvation, man's will. You can't will you into salvation, work it out hard by yourself. It's going to have to be something God does. God must save you. And what he's getting at is grace. We don't earn it. It's a gift. And his point is that this gift is revealed in Jesus and is to be received in faith. The life brings light. So he hits on this theme of life, but the other theme he keeps hitting on, which is equally rampant in this passage, that Jesus is a light. In fact, he describes the incarnation as the light coming into the world. He came to bear witness about the light, the true light, depending on your translation, that gives light to all or enlightens all men, was coming into the world. The picture here is that in the incarnation of Jesus, when he is born, it's like a light bursting into a dark room. It shines in the darkness, and the darkness does not overcome it. He grabs here just a powerful picture. And again, it reinforces Jesus' revealing work. But darkness never beats light. I've never gone into like a dark room, turned on the light switch, it starts to turn on, and the darkness just swallowed it up, and the light bulb like blew up or something. Light always wins. But he describes our state as being in darkness, in need of light. In both the sense of needing life and needing light, he's describing our fallen state. What he's saying is we can't see what we ought to see. In the same sense that when we walk out here and look around and see the world, we ought to go, wow, there's a God. He's a good God. Creation screams it. Romans says that's revealed in creation. But we don't see it because we're in darkness. It's not that we're necessarily just dodging it in the same sense that a person in darkness just can't see. That there's something broken in us when we come into this world that leaves us dead and dark. And that defines and shapes our culture. And so God's response is to send light into a dark room so that our eyes can be open and so that we can see. Not everybody responds. He makes it clear that he comes to his own. They don't receive him. He comes in the world that he made, and even though he made it, that world does not recognize him. But he's like, he hastens and says, but don't get too upset. To those who do, he gives the right to become the children of God. That this light shines, not everybody responds to it well, but some do. And those who do, who receive it and believe on him, they get the life. Light dispels darkness instead of being overcome by it. And light comes to us, that it's an active work of Jesus. The analogy that always comes to my mind was as my sister was sharing about her time in Alaska, which is a dark place, literally, for half the year. But the village culture is a dark place in other ways, too. The median age is very, very young, because death rates are very young. Suicide is rampant, and usually when one person commits suicide, they have a string of suicides. And in small villages, that becomes very depressing and very dark. And to live with the people who have no hope, broken family structures, no sense of how to live and how to treat each other, can be overwhelming and dark. And I remember when Michelle came back from her trip, she made the point that this verse was a reminder to her that the darkness does not overcome light. Light always overcomes darkness. And so no matter how dark and impossible those days might look and those village situations might seem and feel, our belief is that in Jesus is a light that can overcome that darkness. I might look at a situation and go, that's so broken. I don't even know what good would look like there. I'm in darkness. But when Jesus shows up, he reveals what redeemed humanity could look like. Because he clothed himself in humanity and lived a holy life, he is redeemed humanity. In a sense, he was humanity as we have never seen it or experienced it, but as it was always supposed to be. And so he functions as a life. Meet Jesus and you will see who you were supposed to be. Meet Jesus and you'll see how you're supposed to be living in your situation. And so he reveals the glory of God in our context. And so this idea of it brings light to all or enlightens all is this idea that it reaches out to everybody. And so even though it's rejected by some or even many, it is received by some, but the light shines out to everybody. And then ultimately, where he's been coming to is that this light is revealing God. He became flesh so that we could see the invisible God. And so this is who our Jesus is. And when we look at how God has engaged the world in Jesus, the things we want to take away then is that the problem is that we're in darkness of mind apart from the life of God. The solution is that God comes to us, penetrating our world, taking on our flesh without diminishing his divinity. The incarnation is like a light entering a dark room so that we can see the way it ought to be put in order. The picture that jumps out to me is, I like to go caving. I haven't got to do it in years, but in my high school years, this was a thing. And by caving, I mean not the ones where you buy a ticket and walk through lighted pathways, but where you go in natural caves and you strap on a helmet and you crawl around. I remember we'd crawl down in there and it just gets dark. And then we'd get deep in the one cave and we'd sit on a rock slab and we'd turn off our headlamps and just sit there for like 15 minutes. And after 15 minutes, you could lift your hand up and you still couldn't see your hand even if it was right here in front of your face. And then what we'd do is we'd get a pack of mints out. We had these like Hall Spearmint ones with little silvery flecks in them. And everyone would put them in their mouth and we'd chew with our mouth open. And in that dark, with your eyes so sensitized because it was so completely dark, you would see sparks flying out of everybody's mouths and it would illuminate the front of their face. It's crazy. You can't see that if we're just sitting here in this room. It was light coming into this darkness and showing us so much. And then we would take a little candle and light it and sit in the middle. And just because of how dark it was, the light, that one little candle would make it so you could see the whole room we were in. And this is this picture that Jesus goes into the darkest place and then suddenly we can see what we couldn't see before. And so he unveils the glory that was there. God's glory was already present. It's not that Jesus makes God glorious. God is glorious. But like a light in a dark room, suddenly we can see it. So our takeaway, if we're going to look at how God has reached out to us and then be his ambassadors to the world, then Jesus gives us a model of how God's love and God's grace reaches out to a dying world. And the first thing is that we've hit on, it's uncompromising. It has an uncompromising redemptive agenda. Uncompromising that he did not ignore. It's not like Jesus pretended we were alive and in light. But he engaged that issue to redeem it. It's the difference between looking at somebody falling in a pit and going, wow, you messed that up. Good luck. You really shouldn't go down there. And jumping in the pit with them to get them out. It's not God sitting from heaven and going, wow, they've messed up this world I've made. You broke it, you bought it. We messed it up. That was us. And yet God's response is not to ignore it, but to engage that reality redemptively. And the challenge for us then is to engage our culture and our relationships, the people we know, with an uncompromising redemptive agenda. I don't pretend everything's okay, but I'm not here just to kick them while they're down. If I call out what's wrong, it's because I want to see them healed. It's because I want to see them restored. That's grace and truth. It takes initiative in the solution. The light was coming into the world. While we were still in darkness, while we were still dead, God comes. He comes to a people who, in a sense, weren't looking for him because he shows up and they don't recognize him. He didn't wait for us to begin crying out and calling out. We were so deceived in our darkness, we wouldn't have known to do it right. But God comes. It takes initiative. So many times when we see the brokenness in our world, we see people acting like they're in darkness, making decisions that show they don't have a sense of God's reality. We just sit back and watch them mess up their lives. Well, the ball's in their court. We justify that. I'm willing, but they got to take the first step. Praise God, that is not how Jesus engaged us. He took the first step. And he came. We still had to respond. It's not like we've been removed from the equation. As many as received him, he gave the right. We have to believe in his name, but he comes to us in a revealing work to reach out graciously to us. And so an incarnational ministry is going to take initiative. It humbles the righteous for the sake of the sinner. Jesus sits in glory on his throne in majesty, and he comes down here to clothe himself in our flesh and to walk in our messed up world, and the very world that he made doesn't recognize him. He was in the world, and the world was made through him, yet the world did not know him. You see the humility in that. His desire to redeem humanity was such that he was willing to be misunderstood, misrepresented, even denied. Not because they were right. They were wrong to see him that way. Jesus gets accused of being a drunkard. He gets accused of being a rabble-rouser and a threat. That one might have been right, the threat part. They don't see him for who he is, the King of glory who made it. Imagine, you're sitting there looking at a person that you made, and they're looking at you, calling you a fraud, and denying you, and mocking you. It's hard enough for me to have people who I don't know pick on me and not like me. But that's not Jesus' situation. He knew every last one. He made them. And to see their eyes look back at him and not get it, not recognize him. He was willing to humble himself, to humble the righteous for the sake of the sinner. So many times we flip it. I'll help you, but you got to step up to my level. Right? Here's my threshold. I'm going to still make sure that I look good, act good, do my thing. And if you'll come over to my clean turf, I'll help you clean up. But I won't go to your dirty area. I don't want somebody to think ill of me. The word for he became flesh and dwelt among us is literally this idea of tenting or tabernacling. The message translation says he moved into our neighborhood, and that's not a bad translation or interpretation, I would say. But he's picking up on the heart of God here. It has always been God's heart to dwell with man. And when John grabs this word tabernacle, he's invoking a story that's been unfolding throughout the whole of Scripture. It's why he went back to the beginning. Because in the beginning, God didn't make a world and say, this is my half and that's your half. He made the world and he stationed us in a garden where he would come and meet with us and dwell with us. And even when sin fractured that, we have a gracious God who never gave up on that agenda. And so he calls Abraham out to create a people who will be his possession. And over he says that twice as he's leading Moses to free the people from Egypt. He says, I want to redeem for myself a people. They will be my people and I will be their God. And this whole episode with Sinai is the transition from initially an Israel where you've got Israel and a tabernacle set outside the camp, far away, to after the ordeal with the golden calf and a repentant people fall on their faces before God, and Moses confesses, we don't even want to leave here if you won't go with us. God says, okay, I'll go with you and I'll do something like has never been done before. You will be my people and I will be your God. And you find as they're traveling later, especially as they're taking the land, that they change the arrangement and they put the tabernacle in the middle of the camp and they station all the tribes around it. And quite literally, God's tabernacling is moving in into the center of his people. There's still separations because of the sinfulness and God's holiness. Even though he's in the center of the camp, he's hidden by curtains. Then as you get the temple and the ritual festival cycles of Israel, it makes their daily life revolve around God. That every event, every major event of the seasons and things involves these great festivals of coming to the temple and giving of your first fruits. And over, it's a God who desires to meet with man by tabernacling and templing with them. And John picks that up and says, God has always been a God who's willing to humble himself, to make himself accessible to us, to reach out to us, to patiently draw us in, because God's desire is to dwell with man. Do we have that desire to see people brought into relationship with God? This is the heart of why John would describe himself as the disciple whom Jesus loved, is he understands the whole reason Jesus showed up is because God loves us enough that he still wants to be with us despite everything. And in Jesus, what God's been doing across all time is coming to this profound climax where the temple curtain can be torn in two when Jesus dies on the cross and God unleashes himself on the world to loving the redeemed, to dwell among. Would we do that? Would we be like God and go to the broken, go where the broken are, to go to the places that are dark? Humbling ourselves. I've shared this story with many of you before. But it's what comes to my mind whenever I look at this. The dilemma of incarnational ministry for me is always this humbling, because I like people to like me. I like people to think well of me. I don't like people to misunderstand me, to think ill of me, or to assume bad things of me, especially if I didn't do it. You're going to think bad of me, I want at least to have gotten away with something. Here comes Jesus being flagrantly misunderstood, so much so that they kill him, his own people. And so, you know, I've shared with you guys, I have a friend here in the city, and from time to time he gets groups together to play pool, and his whole agenda was to get believers and non-believers together so they talk. And that pool's a great thing because it's not a very active sport, and so you can chat a lot. And so he had invited me to come out and be one of the guys who was willing to talk, because he had a hard time getting Christians to come out. The non-believers were all for meeting and playing pool and hanging out and talking. Christians didn't want to go in a pool hall. I figured I could handle that, so I went and played pool with them, and the guys started talking, and we were getting to talk about spiritual things. It was awesome. Amazing opportunity. So they don't want to stop talking when we finish playing pool. He's like, well, let's go over to the bar, get dinner, and keep talking. Context here. Last people saying, I'm really enjoying these conversations about Jesus. Let's not stop. Can we go over to the bar? My dilemma? I lead a youth ministry. It's amazing how quickly, out of concern for reputation, we start constructing scenarios. What if, as I'm walking to the bar, one of the parents of my youth ministry happens to be driving by the bar at that moment? I mean, we're playing weird statistics at this point. And they see me, and they assume that I'm going to go in there and get drunk and do bad things. I mean, you hear all the ifs in there. If they happen to see me. If when they see me, they would assume the worst. And if they would not talk to me to find out what actually happened. And if they wouldn't believe me and when I tell them what I was doing. I could lose my reputation and have someone think ill of me. Maybe they'd even pull their kid out of my ministry. You have to go. And like, how far would that go? Would you lose, what, one kid maybe? But we're so paranoid of being thought well of, I actually had to pause and was in deep deliberation over whether I would go and sit with these guys and talk about Jesus in a bar. And honestly, it's to my shame that it took me way longer than it should to go, I know what I need to do. It wasn't even that I didn't know. I remember going, what would Jesus do? Well, I know he'd be in there already. He'd be sitting down talking up a storm with these guys, because he did that, and he got accused of everything I was afraid of being accused of. I mean, this wasn't even like I need to adapt a story. Jesus hung out with tax collectors, and the Pharisees accused him of being a wine bibbler. He literally did what I was struggling with. And I struggled. And I had to pray, God, I know my heart's wrong. You're going to have to help me work up the guts to take this opportunity. It revealed to me that while I might be good at being a Christian in the Christian culture sense, I wasn't that great at being like Jesus. Because when it came time to humble myself, I would rather that the lost person come into my light place than that I go into their dark place to be a light. See, if they wanted to come to church here and we can sit and chat in an environment that I controlled and I set up and everything's cool, I'm down. But if I have to go where they are, then I struggle. Lest I have to humble myself. Incarnational ministry says the righteous is the one who takes the initiative, humbles himself, and goes in the dark. Now, don't misunderstand this. That doesn't mean I go, okay, so I want to be an incarnational, so I go to the bar, I get wasted, I try and live as much like them as possible because I want to be in their world. That would be a light going into the darkness and turning itself off as it enters the dark room. Doesn't really accomplish anything. When Jesus came, while he was willing to go all those places, he did so and remained Jesus. He remained different. He remained distinct. None of his divinity was diminished or compromised, but he could go there. It's the question of how do I go there and still represent Jesus? To go into the dark place and take the God that they don't see and make him visible in that place. That's what verse 18 is getting at. Is yes, he went there, but when he did, he walked into a dark room and he pulled back the curtain and the glory of God showed up in a place people weren't used to seeing it. incarnational ministry unveils the glory of God in dark places. So that's the challenge for us, is how do I go into dark places with the light still on? How do I look at these places and these situations and these relationships and go, what would it look like if this was transformed into the likeness of Jesus? If when you looked at this situation, you saw something of God here rather than what we see, which is something of broken humanity. And how can I be a witness to that as I go there? How do I live and demonstrate that difference?